This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Hello, Buzzkillers. This is the Professor here. This episode was recorded live at Coffee Tree Roasters. And for the first time ever, we've had audience participation. That's right. Members of the audience, Buzzkillers all, asked us questions and we answered them. So now, on to the show. Yes, indeed, it's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths, taking names. You know, one of the things we like to do on this show is talk about all sorts of aspects of historical myths, including what I would call a chronological myth. I've always thought that climate change science was a relatively new thing, and worries about climate change and about global warming and all sorts of other things like that are relatively recent, but they're not. And fortunately, very, very fortunately, we have here an expert, Dr. Andrew Ramey from Carnegie Mellon University. He's an environmental historian, and he's going to help us try to understand the history of climate change science. Not necessarily the history of climate change, but how it's been studied. We're going to have two episodes because this is such a big topic. Today, we're going to talk about the 19th century. Then the next episode, if you're willing to come back, then we'll have a 20th century episode. What is the deeper history of climate change science? Why do we have this sort of misunderstanding that it's all my generation or the hippies from Woodstock who suddenly said, hey, let's gin up this thing called climate change and scare everybody in the 21st century?
You know, climate change myths are some of the most insidious. And in some ways, we can treat the whole lot of them as kind of a meta myth. And I will try to keep the jargon to a minimum. Please kick me hard if I stray too far into scholarly jargon. But there is this larger myth that concerns the role between people and nature, and this idea that somehow people couldn't possibly change the climate. It's too big. It's too complex. There's no way that, you know, little old humans could be doing that. So it must be some left-wing conspiracy from the hippies to try to regulate our lives and destroy our freedom, because we couldn't possibly be putting so much carbon into the atmosphere that we're changing the composition and the way that heat flows work across the entire planet.
Okay, so what you're saying is there are two myths. There are myths that climate change isn't happening, but there's also this meta myth that humans can't, meta meaning bigger, larger, above, all encompassing, that people can't really change something like the environment.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So when we look at the historical record, we can see for how long people have been understanding climate change, both the science and understanding ways we think about climate change. And these myths take on a lot of different forms. Some of my favorite examples, climate change isn't happening because of volcanoes, it's really them, or it's sunspots changing the way our climate functions, or the Earth's orbit is wobbly. There's the classic, there's no scientific consensus, which some buzzkillers may have heard. Yeah. It's all just a conspiracy. You also get people saying the climate's always been changing, this is nothing new. And you even get people saying that global warming will be good, and they'll lean into it and say, no, this is great, no more winter, perpetual beach weather, right. No problems.
Well, I found something. In fact, I was sending it to you the other day as we were preparing for the show, a YouTube thing that came from the Bell Telephone history, or the Bell Telephone science show back in the 50s. And they were saying things like, and look, we'll be able to grow crops in the middle of Greenland and everything like that. And it, you know, what a great boon this will be. And it was obviously, you know, nutcases, but given that Greenland is in the news nowadays, maybe we need to think about that. So that's an important way to think about the way this show essentially tries to address historical myths. But usually they're on the sort of basic level, like you said, volcanoes and stuff, and on this larger level.
So let's go back and start with like the whole, it emerges with the hippies in the 1970s. So this
go ahead. The Duke of Buzzkill and Duchess of Buzzkill are both of the hippie generation, so, you know. We better cool it with the hippie language.
Much respect.
They weren't at Woodstock, but they were close.
Well, during the 1960s and 70s, this is when the environmental movement writ large enters the popular consciousness, and it's when the popular media really starts to report on some of these issues. So what I'd love to do today is talk about the deeper history of the science, because by the time you start getting some media reporting on this issue in the 1960s and 70s, scientists, by and large, understand the basic mechanics of what's going on. And the question between now and then has been, you know, how much can we fine-tune our models? How well can we describe what's going on? The nuts and bolts of this thing were really in place by the 1950s. So it's perfectly understandable why you might start having this conception of climate change being associated with environmentalism in the 1970s or the hippies. But really, this goes all the way back to the 18th century with the Enlightenment and some of the first sustained thinking in a rational way about human relationships to the natural world.
Okay, now the Enlightenment, we want to remind buzzkillers, is a period, especially in European history and in early modern American history, where people talk about reason and rationality and what we might call the beginnings of scientific approaches to things.
Absolutely. And buzzkillers may have heard of the scientific revolution. Mm-hmm. Happens around the same time, a little bit later, depending on which version of historiography suits your interests. But long story short, you start getting some sustained thinking in the 18th century with even big names. Guys like Thomas Jefferson and David Hume were actually thinking in a sustained way about climate, about science, and about climate change.
Now, David Hume, the famous Scottish philosopher, and Thomas Jefferson, I think he was notable for a few things.
Yeah, Thomas Jefferson, he helped the Marquis de Lafayette draft the Declaration of the Rights of Man, probably most famous achievement. There may be something else. I think he's on currency somewhere.
Yeah, he's about to be kicked off the nickel. But the David Hume thing is interesting to me because David Hume is considered a philosopher, but also a natural philosopher. And natural philosopher is one of the terms that we use to describe early scientists.
Absolutely.
Right? It's not like all of a sudden in the Enlightenment they said, oh, hey, we need a bunch of scientists now. We're going to invent this thing called science. It sort of evolves out of philosophy and other things into the rational inquiry into nature.
Absolutely. And not to take us too far afield, but one of the central guiding questions of the Enlightenment was how can you rationally improve humanity? How can you find progress in civilization? And so the environment became a big question for some of these Enlightenment thinkers. I use Hume because he's one people may have heard of, and we'll get to Jefferson in a minute. But the question was, what's the relationship between humanity and nature? And a lot of these Enlightenment thinkers thought that there was a pretty clear connection. You could explain why certain peoples acted in certain ways because they were either from northern climates and they were more robust and they had to work harder to stay warm, or they were lazy people from southern climates and they got to lounge around in the sun and pick olives and dates and figs all day.
That's why the Vikings conquered Europe, supposedly.
Exactly. And on my mom's side, I'm Italian, and on my dad's side, I'm French and Irish, so I can play both sides of the climate spectrum there.
Yeah.
So these Enlightenment thinkers, led by Hume and other guys, saw this connection between environment and people, and they thought, well, why can't we change the environment? And one of the popular ideas going around was that if you replace forests with agriculture and cultivated fields,
right. You
actually can warm the environment, you can make it more temperate, you can reduce the extremes, you'll make winters milder, and you'll produce a more robust, industrious race of people. And this is what takes us to Jefferson, because he was one of the apologists for the early republic, trying to argue that, you know, give us time. We may not have the achievements of Europe and science and all that, but we're cutting down our forests. We're putting fields in there. We'll be a nation of yeoman farmers. And when we change the physical landscape, the climate will change too. It will be more conducive to that Western European civilization.
Now, are they noticing that this is happening? I mean, people only live a certain number of decades. Can they say, oh, well, when I was young, and therefore, since everything is now moving towards agriculture, I can see that things are getting warmer and better in theory.
Well, and Jefferson claims this. This is why he's such an interesting guy. He was a big observer of the natural world. One of his other famous works, Notes on Virginia, probably his most famous, I think. I can safely say that. Big historical consensus, Notes on Virginia, by far.
More famous than the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, buzzkillers, note my sense of humor sometimes can be a bit dry. Anyway, so in Notes on Virginia, he claims that he has evidence that this has happened. He talks about, you know, village elders who had harsher winters in their youth, and he claims to have, you know, diaries from people showing that winters used to be a lot colder in Virginia, and over time they've warmed up, and as cultivation mm-hmm. has spread, as more and more acres have gone from forest to fields, that the climate itself is moderated. One of the sub-themes is that, you know, pine trees
uh-huh.
have more hoarfrost. So if you cut down all the pine trees and plant, you know, corn, you'll moderate the climate.
Pine trees have more what? Hoarfrost?
Hoarfrost. That
what
is a technical
God's name
term.
Is hoarfrost?
it's the frost. Like when you see, when you wake up in the morning and there's frost on the ground, it's kind of, that's called hoarfrost. And so in the trees, they would observe more of it and just draw the false conclusion based on the correlation of frost and trees.
Right. Okay. Well, now we have a new word in our Buzzkill lexicon, hoarfrost. I'm going to drop that in. The Buzzlings won't understand what I'm talking about when I'm trying
sure
to get
FCC
them up in the morning.
Understands. This is
because this is a PG show.
Scientific term.
So what's the big difference between, say, 18th century, the 18th century study of this kind of stuff, and you might say the 20th, 21st century study of this kind of stuff?
That's a great place to rewind to. So in the 18th century, physics and chemistry are not as well developed as they are now. Science is a lot mm-hmm. more observational. And the big theories on climate change have to do with agriculture. I kind of hinted at this earlier, that a lot of the claims that these natural philosophers are making have to do with what humans are doing to the landscape. The atmosphere is sort of dimly considered insofar as people are thinking about the atmosphere. They're thinking about it in relation to how cutting down forests is changing wind flows. And there's a whole interesting sub-theme about what people thought came out of the ground. Back before you have germ theory, you have people thinking that certain diseases come from miasmas that come out of the ground. And this is very interesting, but kind of beside the point. At this stage, the focus is more on the land and less on the atmosphere.
Is it because there isn't really an understanding of carbon dioxide, or is it more subtle than that?
You're absolutely right. It's because there's not an understanding of how carbon dioxide functions.
Uh-huh.
This is something we'll get to a little bit later in the 18th century with some of the scientists we're going to meet in this story.
Well, then let's jump into that. You said there's a lot of myth-making about carbon's role in climate change, so how does that enter the story?
This is one of the great convergences in history, and I don't want to get too nerdy and too scholarly, but historians love these things where you see a bunch of different social movements, intellectual trends, random accidents come together to create a major change, and we get this with climate science. So one of the big sub-themes in climate science is the Bible. It's really important because everything you need to know is in there. Early geologists were, and to be sincere, like to understand people in their times, you took the Bible as being a fairly accurate representation of part of the cosmology of the world. And so one of the questions early geologists had was, what about the flood, right? If there was this huge flood, wouldn't there be evidence in like the rocks? And so many geologists went out looking for evidence of this. And what they found was actually evidence of ice ages. And this is a great irony because you had some guys who were pretty sincere believers in the Bible, in Christianity. They grew up in this Judeo-Christian world. They went out and they found these ice ages and thought, this doesn't make sense. There's no way we could have these ice caps over like most of Europe and North America within the past 6,000 years. So that doesn't add up.
Because it doesn't fit in with the Bible chronology.
Right, exactly. Thank you for clearing that up. So,
by the way, when are these geologists saying this? What time are what period are they working? What years are
they talking working? Early 19th century, so 1820s.
1820s, okay.
1810s, gotcha. 1820s, 1830s. There's a bunch of famous geologists who I'm not going to get into because I feel like I'm already spiraling enough as it is into side currents and eddies. But these geologists basically establish ice ages have come and gone, and then one of the big questions is, well how? How do you get huge, mile-thick sheets of ice coming down over North America and Europe?
Hmm.
What's causing this? Is it volcanoes? Is it sunspots?
Is it the original idea. Yeah.
Right, the original idea. So you see some of these myths and misconceptions about what climate science is go back a very long time into very genuine, legitimate scientific debates. And when we get to the 20th century in our next episode, some weeks from now, we'll
if you're
talk,
willing to come
if
back.
If I'm willing to come back.
If the audience is willing
If you're
to
willing
come
to
back.
Have me back. A lot of these misconceptions come out of legitimate early scientific disagreements. So we've got this one strand of geologists. And on the other hand, you have early physics and early chemistry. We mentioned carbon dioxide. And you start to have people doing experiments with visible light and infrared radiation. One of the first people to kind of theorize that you could have a global warming and greenhouse effect.
Right.
He's one of the biggest names in physics. Jean-Baptiste Joseph Fourier, French physicist, really famous name. Math nerds might know him from like the Fourier series. And he starts doing some experiments with visible light, and he shows that carbon dioxide can kind of trap and absorb heat. So you've got geologists looking for the Ice Age, physicists and chemists, and then you also
and
start
this
getting...
is still the 1820s
this is
and 30s.
Still the 1820s and 30s.
Crikey.
So they're developing their science into the 1850s, and at that time, we actually start getting observations of real-world melting glaciers. People in Switzerland, people in Siberia, you start to get some reports that the planet actually is warming. And so you start to see these things coming together where you're noticing changes in the natural world, and several different branches of science are advancing to the point where you can start to construct a theory that explains all this stuff.
Is it just coincidence that geologists are looking for the evidence of the flood, that Fourier is doing all this stuff, and David Hume is cranking out stuff, and Thomas Jefferson, who's now getting a little bit older, but you know, they're all doing this in the... Is this why we get all excited about the Enlightenment? Because there seems to be this tremendous energy in thinking?
Yeah, and something we can talk about for another day is the role of the state in all this. Because behind some of these, you know, great scientists, you know, great individual geniuses, that's another sub-myth, you have state funding for scientific institutions and associations that sponsor this research, that sponsor journals to publish things. So there is an infrastructure and institutions that encourage the dissemination of knowledge and the communication and all the academic conferences that you and I decry these days over conference. You know, they trace their origins back to this period in the 19th century where these scientific societies start getting formed so people can communicate, so physicists can talk to the geologists.
Huh. That's absolutely fascinating. Well, I'll tell you what, let's do, Professor. We're going to take a little quick break for station identification, and we'll be back in a minute.
This is Mary Todd Lincoln. President Lincoln is indisposed at the moment, but he asked me to remind you that Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers. We're back with Dr. Andrew Ramey from Carnegie Mellon University, who's advising us on the history of climate change science. I want to circle back a little bit to something you said before the break. You know, we talked about Fourier and all these other scientific discoveries and this sort of convergence of all these people. But we tend, and one of the things we really hate on this show is the great man, the great individual theory of history.
Oh, right? I hate great men. Yeah. Show off.
And so how do we get out of that in climate change science? Because it sounds like we've mentioned David Hume, who's hugely famous. We've mentioned Thomas Jefferson, who's hugely famous, man, with this new Fourier guy. It looks as if, you know, these great titans stride on the scene and then start explaining everything.
Yeah, I think that's a really important myth that we see pop up in a lot of different historical dimensions. You know, political history, economic history, scientific history is no different. In some ways, scientific history is especially vulnerable to this. Like if you conjure up, you know, the archetype of your typical scientist, you think maybe an older, white-haired dude scribbling away in a lab, and that's actually a historian. That's not a scientist. It's just a lonely historian working on his chalkboard or her chalkboard.
But it's like Newton and all those other people, you know,
right, or
the
Einstein,
lonely genius
like
sitting under the tree. Yeah. Right, yeah.
And something that I mentioned a bit before the break is so much of this work is collaborative, especially nowadays. Mm-hmm. Like you look at papers in scientific journals today, and again, disclaimer, this is a history of science, not the state of the art in science. But you look at journals today and they have so many co-authors. You have a whole paragraph of co-authors.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember that. So when we talk about some of these names, a lot of that is historical myth-making where you look back and the narratives, and sometimes people will be good self-promoters. Scientists can be good self-promoters. So you take a guy like Svante Arrhenius, who was really famous in terms of the history of climate science, and he gets kind of this outsized role for what he did.
Okay, tell us more about him? What, who is he? Is he on the same level with Fournier and all these others?
So Arrhenius is an interesting guy. He's someone that buzzkillers might know. He won a Nobel Prize in chemistry. He was a chemist, and he's sometimes dubbed the father of climate change science or the father of global warming. Because way back in 1896, he actually made a pretty accurate prediction on what doubling CO2 in the atmosphere would do to the climate.
Wait, let me just have a little... brief pause for a shock here. 1896?
Yes.
He's figuring out carbon emissions, CO2 emissions in 1896?
Before the Spanish-American War, we had in published scientific journals a fairly accurate estimation of how much the Earth would warm, you know, with a reasonable error bar, wow, if we doubled CO2.
Wow. That's just, it's astounding. Again, we're breaking down this huge story that is just the hippies from the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah, it's a much...
It's the hippies from the 1860s right, and
70s. Yeah, and well, and you know, Arrhenius is an interesting guy, so...
By the way, Buzz, because we're going to have all this Arrhenius and everything else spelled out on the blog post for this episode, so you can look all that up.
And hopefully a pronunciation guide, because we read these things, but I so rarely hear them pronounced. So hopefully we're not doing poor Svante injustice. So he's a Swede, right? And he's very interested in glaciers. One of the concerns is that what if these glaciers come back? And if you live in Sweden and you think there's a chance glaciers might return, you're first in line to get crushed. That's not a happy place to be. So the first myth with this guy is, yes, he made some accurate predictions, but he was very pro-global warming. Like, in his scientific papers, he's like, this is great. I can't wait. We'll be able to grow, like, dates in
and
Stockholm.
Olives, yeah.
Yeah, dates
Sweden.
And olives in Stockholm.
Okay. So this is part of that. Well, there are a number of people like this, that global warming will be a good thing and make life better on more divergent places in the geography of the world, the continents of the world.
And I think so... We'll circle back to Arrhenius in a second, but what he and others share is this idea that it will take centuries and centuries for these changes mm-hmm. to take place, mm-hmm. and they'll be super gradual. He could not conceive of the scale in which technology would explode in the 20th century and just the exponential growth in fossil fuel consumption and in resource use globally. The predictions that he made, he thought it would take centuries to get there. Instead... in 80 years, essentially.
Right. Well, okay, tell us more about his calculations.
Yeah, so this goes back to the myth-making with Arrhenius, is most historians of science note that he was really more lucky than good. So he had an incomplete data set, and he left some important things out, like he had no real clear guess or assumptions about how the oceans worked, and oceans are hugely important in the carbon cycle. Mm. But the reason why he was lucky is he left out enough things that mitigated global warming and left out enough things that enhanced it so that his mistakes canceled themselves out and he's mostly accurate in his calculations. His math was good. Like, give him a ton of credit for doing very complex equations, you know, by hand in 1896. Did not have the benefit of computers. His stuff would be like fully verified in the 1950s with like early huge room-sized computers. Hmm. So the math there, top-notch. Give him credit for that. But some of the assumptions going into his model were not fully spot on.
So how does he get the word out?
One of the advantages, we talked about these networks that scientists have.
Yeah.
Buzzkillers may know another famous scientist who is a Swede. This dude, Alfred Nobel.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
Inventor of dynamite. They named a prize after him. So the Swedish Academy of Science is a pretty big deal. And he's able to have that as a platform to talk about these ideas.
And the Swedish Academy of Science, people who give out the Nobel Prize.
Key point. So what's really important for Arrhenius is, like so many of the so-called like fathers and founders of these things, he's really the popularizer. So he didn't invent the theory of global warming. He credits others with it. He didn't, you know, discover that carbon dioxide absorbs heat. What he did do was use his platform to spread this message. And I'd like to read you a direct quotation. This is a couple years later. This is 1903. And this is, you know, 100 plus years ago. This gives you a sense of how accurate this was. Here's the quote: that the atmospheric envelopes limit the heat losses from the planets has been suggested about 1800 by the great French physicist Fourier. His ideas were further developed afterwards by Pouillet and Tyndall.
Two other scientists.
Their theory has been styled the hothouse theory because they thought that the atmosphere acted after the manner of the glass panes of hothouses, unquote.
So what I'm hearing in this quote is that this so-called father of global warming science is crediting other scientists before even scientists going back 100 years.
Unfortunately, we can't call him the father of global warming. Sorry to be buzzkill.
All you Swedes out there can send a hate. It's hate mail at professorbuzzkill.com. Well, okay. Now, if we put him aside for a minute and return to the original sort of myth, would it be fair to say that, again, instead of a bunch of hippies like my parents coming up with the idea of global warming in the 70s, the Woodstock hangover, we have a century of work plus done by some of these huge names in science?
Yeah, that's
I mean, it's
exactly
not just by
right.
committee, it is the individuals and a bunch of other people working on it.
Yeah, I think we can be flexible enough to accommodate important influencers like Arrhenius. Key points along the way. Big names are helpful to hang your hat on, but there's a lot of work and we couldn't even touch on everyone. So, I feel bad shortchanging some of these guys. And, while the 20th century and the period since the 1970s has seen a phenomenal development in the precision and the understanding of climate processes, the basics were really well understood by 1900.
1900? God, this is still blowing my mind.
That quote that I read you, so this quote from 1903, what I love, it's a little bit technical, but he name drops Fourier, he name drops two other really big scientists, and he's like, no big deal. Like, this idea has been around since 1800. We've been slowly developing it.
Yeah.
So Arrhenius himself is very much like, this is a thing. Climate, we can project climate change based on carbon dioxide. And this idea of the greenhouse effect is nothing new. I mean, he called it the hothouse theory, but scientists were beginning to understand how CO2 traps heat.
Okay, so we've understood for over 100 years, and you've explained all these various people analyzing and telling us that humans can affect the atmosphere. We've understood this for 100 years. Well, how can this possibly be a new thing?
This is really important because, as I said at the outset, one thing a lot of climate myths share in common is that humans simply cannot influence climate. The atmosphere is too big. Climate processes are too complex. It must be ideology. So what this history shows us is scientists are able to fairly precisely explain just how humans could do this, and that more importantly, the cultural ideas out of which this science emerged. This is where we rewind to Jefferson and to Hume. There's no question that people could change the climate. It was a basic assumption that, of course, humans are powerful enough to control the environment. Environmental historians of my day, we like to deconstruct the notion that man has control over nature. But during the height of the Enlightenment, in this era of tremendous social and technological progress and change, people did think they could control the climate. And so it's actually kind of weird that we have this new idea that, we can't control climate, when in fact we've known for hundreds of years that we as a species very much can change the Earth around us.
Were there people arguing against the idea that humans can control the climate in the 19th century and early 20th century? Were there people saying, No, Fourier, this isn't true. God is too big or nature is too big to allow us to do this?
Absolutely. There were a lot of environmental determinists, and some of their theories got pretty
nasty. What
does
environmental determinists mean?
Environmental determinists are scientists, but usually social scientists or theorists who think that environmental factors are going to be all controlling. So where you're born determines who you are. And the nasty version of this is in scientific racism, where you think certain people, because of their genes, because of where they're born, or because of who their parents were, are morally, intellectually, physically inferior. And they would trace a lot of that to the climate. So there is a substrain of people, you could call it pseudoscience if you wanted to be uncharitable, who see the environment as being deterministic of people and determining the character of civilizations, determining the character of individuals.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there's a lot to this, and it certainly has changed my mind tremendously, and I'm sure that's going to change a lot of buzzkillers' minds because of all this depth and all this chronological background. Why is the history so important? What can you folks, historians of science, add to this current debate on climate science?
Well, I think showing that context, that it's not a recent phenomenon, it's not new, It's understandable why people would have myths and misconceptions. We tend to think of science as being this, you know, new 20th century thing. But if you rewind to the origins of science, if you go back to the Scientific Revolution and the Enlightenment, you see that people took it for granted. Not everyone, as you fairly point out. But this idea that, of course, people can change nature, that the really weird new radical ideology are people who argue that humans can't change nature. And we've seen all that's gone on since the 19th century. Hopefully, we'll come back for part two and talk about some of those changes in the 20th century. But for now, I'd just like to leave Buzzkillers with the idea that going into the 20th century, there's a really robust physical and chemical understanding of how carbon dioxide works, good predictions for what putting more carbon dioxide into the air would do, and a broader cultural understanding that humans can change the planet in big transformative ways.
Well, it's a damn good thing you're coming back, because I know a lot of Buzzkillers who are listening to this show are going to say, well, we want more. You know, we want the 20th century. What happens after 1903? And now, as promised, we're going to have audience members here, Coffee Tree Roasters, actually ask questions. So here we go. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thanks for coming on the show. And you, by the way, are the first Buzzkiller to ever ask a question directly on the show. So have at it.
Thank you for the privilege. My name is Jesse Edelman. The early climate scientists, did they have any comments on what was then developing industrialization? Did they think that that had a direct influence on the atmosphere, or was it more abstract?
Okay, so these are the early 19th century scientists?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, they did. And what's so interesting about those scientists is, even though they understood what carbon dioxide did and its role in the atmosphere, they saw industry as being a basic good. This is still in this post-Enlightenment era. We haven't gotten to like fun postmodern critiques of like Western civilization yet.
Say that word.
I can't help it. I think I'm contractually obligated to mention postmodernism at least once a day since getting my doctorate. Anyway, to answer your question, these early scientists believed at an ideological level in their mission of rational inquiry and in its potential to improve the human condition. So there's like a naive optimism to this whole business that, you know, if we just understand the world, we can make it better. So yes, they understood the consequences of burning all this fossil fuel. They recognized you're going to change the composition of the atmosphere, but that understanding was embedded within a larger hope that this project of technological progress, rationalization, would lead to a better civilization.
Okay, we have another question. Tell us who you are first.
Hi, my name is Dario. I have a question about a general history of climate science. So I'm obviously, with empirical science, there's a lot of uncertainty that happens as a science matures. I'm wondering if we can extrapolate a sort of trend in better and better predictions about climate change that has happened over time, as since the time that Fourier was doing a science with carbon dioxide up until now. I wonder if we can sort of see a trend of better and better predictions over time.
I think the word that I like that you used is trend, because there's going to be times when we take two steps forward and there's going to be times when we take one step back. We'll talk about this next week on the show, but carbon dioxide has this very checkered history where it seems like it's on the rise, no pun intended, and then scientists start to doubt it. So I don't want to give away the game for next week. Stay tuned. But what I will say for this week is, one of the things the 19th century scientists were missing, a big part of the calculations they didn't understand, was the role of the oceans. There were a couple of different theories about what oceans did depending on how much they mixed. So under one theory, just for simplicity, we'll call it Theory A. Theory A of the oceans is they are just a carbon sink. The oceans mix really well. They absorb carbon dioxide from the air, and it gets trapped in sediment and is part of a million-year geologic cycle. And in that scenario, then, woohoo, we can put as much carbon as we want because the oceans will suck it in. That's not quite the case. Theory B, oceans mix to a certain extent. They'll absorb carbon dioxide to a certain extent, but then once they hit their capacity, then excess carbon dioxide isn't being absorbed and it's accumulating in the atmosphere. And guys in the 19th century didn't know this. They didn't understand the oceans. They did not have oceans incorporated into their climate models, but we do today. And one of the scary things is we're seeing an acceleration in warming because the wiggle room, the margin of error we have as a society to take action on this, with the oceans being able to absorb stuff, that's gone now. We're starting to notice some really terrifying changes in the oceans. But again, in the 19th century, oceans weren't even a part of the model. So the trend, yes, is really upward towards understanding better and better, and there's some real hope in that.
Okay, yes, next question. You are?
I am Doug. I'd like to ask you, you've talked a little bit about CO2 and sort of the history of CO2 in this broader conversation. Can you do the same with methane?
Ooh, yes, cow farts, so much fun. I'm less well-versed in the history of methane. Buzzkillers, this is your quick science hour from a not-quite-scientist, but methane is actually a much more... it absorbs much more heat than carbon dioxide does as a molecule. I'm going to sound like an idiot to actual scientists out there, but it's really important.
Never admit that.
Yeah. Well, so the role of methane was not part of the 19th century story. So we sort of cut that out of this arc because the chemistry was not well enough developed to really capture this role. But what we know now is that it's super effective at capturing heat. And one of the big problems, and I'm veering way out of the 19th century here, one of the big problems today is when we start talking about the melting of the permafrost up in the Arctic Circle, it's going to release a ton of methane from decaying vegetation, and that will amplify global warming effects. So that's really scary. So we had a great question earlier about, you know, what wasn't in the trends. I'd like to piggyback your question on that. Methane was not part of the story in the 19th century, just like the oceans weren't part of the story. That's something that's been incorporated. But that's something that's easy to adjust. I mean, I joked earlier about the cow farts, but a lot of methane emissions come from livestock. And that's something we can control really easy and really efficiently in how we choose what to eat and where that's coming from. I can't help but resist making a comment about the burning of the Amazon rainforest right now. A lot of that is, you know, direct and intentional to supply Western desires for beef. I won't go too hard on the soapbox, but methane is a source of carbon or a source of global warming greenhouse gases that we can pretty aggressively control if that's something we want to do. It's not as thorny as, you know, rewriting the whole energy infrastructure, but that's way afield from the 19th century. Come back next week when we talk about the 20th century.
So just a quick thank you to Dr. Ramey and Buzzkillers. We will talk to you next week.